you could see in that video, we used some of the stats that Derek talked about in his presentation, and also highlighted some of the concepts that are featured in the issue brief and in other materials that we produced for that portion of the initiative. But it served as sort of an entry-level piece, I guess, into the relationship between education and health. We also produced some graphics that, like, have been shown really throughout the presentation, that in a more simplistic way kind of illustrate the concepts we're talking about to be able to communicate these things more clearly. These are shots of the covers of the briefs that we produced, so this is kind of the next step down that ladder. A little bit more involved. They ranged between 5 and 7 pages and included a little bit more information about the mechanisms by which education and health are related and the science behind it. On our website, you can see the cover of a brief right there, so you can download the brief itself. And here you're seeing the content that's featured in the brief. But we've also included expanded content in these Read More links that you can see. So this allows users to take a bit of a deeper dive into the science that is supporting the content even that's in the brief itself. Additionally, like I said, we have continued doing the more traditional production of academic products. So here you have covers from a couple reports related to this project. The first on the left is a discussion paper that was used at an IOM meeting on the Roundtable for Population Health. They had one particular meeting that was focused on education and health and invited us to write a paper to help guide that discussion. And the other one is another publication of the Institute of Medicine where a particular chapter, and really throughout the report, highlights the work we've done with the Education and Health Initiative. So our process, once we've done the strategic planning, once we've talked to the policymakers and figure out what products we want to produce, and once we've produced those products, we have to actually get them out to people. So what we've done here is work with a couple of external communications firms to help identify outlets that could help us get the word out. So we've targeted key influencers by selecting those media that we think they have the most exposure to, that we think could create the largest impact. And additionally, we've continued to use those partnerships that we cultivated earlier on to kind of help with a snowball dissemination of these products. So here is just a brief overview, and it's a lot of content, about some of the outreach that we conducted around this initiative. So the Coalition for Education Funding, the NCSL, the Health Committee, APHA, the Committee for Education Funding, and these other organizations helped significantly in the distribution of these products. That once we established those partnerships and once the products were developed, they helped a lot in sending them out to their listservs and promoting them on social media and the like. Here is just a snippet of some of the media coverage that we've received with these products. So on the left you have just a list of some publications that have covered the products that we've distributed. And on the right is a little bit more information on different newsletters and things that they were included in. Additionally, we've done some social media outreach. So the Education Health Initiative is a 4-phase project. For phase 3 especially, we thought that social media would play a meaningful role in the dissemination of the materials. So we engaged in a Twitter chat around that topic and used the hashtag EdMatters. And through the Twitter chat, we earned over 3.3 million impressions. We had a good amount of help with this Twitter chat, so we did it with our center, but we also had the help of RWJ, who has a really significant following on Twitter. But also this particular brief, we worked with the folks at Kaiser Permanente to pull some of the data that you saw earlier in Derek's portion of the presentation. So they helped also with their substantial Twitter following, and we partnered with our institution, with VCU, to help promote it. So the final phase of this project, the topic will be the return on investment in education, and here we're doing something a little bit different in that we're actually tailoring the products themselves to specific audiences. We thought for this particular phase of the project that the return on investment message kind of took different form with different audiences. So where business leaders cared more about insurance premiums and workforce issues, that the governmental people were probably more concerned about healthcare costs and entitlements and things like that. So we've decided to develop separate briefs for separate audiences, and we'll be producing that series. But that also has implications for our outreach, that our outreach has to be very tailored and very specific for each of those briefs to be able to reach those three very specific audiences. So this isn't something that me sitting at my desk can do by myself. So, so we have a lot of help being able to pull off this kind of more elaborate communications effort and to develop these pretty shiny products that we've seen here. So through the grant, we've been able to work with a pair of communications firms, one that focuses more on public health and one that focuses more on education. So their expertise has been invaluable in being able to target organizations that are important to reach and helping with outreach and media outreach and things like that. Additionally, we work with the School of the Arts and other institutions at VCU to kind of leverage talent within the university to bring in a different, sort of an interdisciplinary approach to be able to do this. So we actually have a graduate assistant from School of the Arts in graphic design that works in our office and helps us spiff up all of these things. So it's definitely a collaborative effort and definitely an interdisciplinary effort. The images here are just to illustrate that we're not the only center doing this. This is something that absolutely can be done other places. Steve mentioned earlier Dr. Purnell's group over at Washington University who's doing similar work. And also the 2x2 project is up at Columbia University. They also combine media and journalism with public health.
So we are about to wrap up our talking to you and then open it up for discussion. I just want to end by saying something that Sarah just mentioned, which is that you can't do this alone, and I want to acknowledge the cast of characters that's made this initiative possible. We've had a lot of partners at VCU, and her point about reaching out to talent that you have on campuses. I don't know how many of you are at academic institutions like we are, but we're fortunate in this particular case because this project was funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and through their generosity, they supported the two communications firms that were helping with us. But for other projects that we do and that you probably do, dollars for this kind of fancy outreach are more scarce. And so we have to get more resourceful at academic institutions and public health departments on how to develop less expensive partnerships with this kind of talent. So at our academic institution, we've really tried to reach out to other partners on campus that through, you know, grad program, graduate school programs, and other models, we can sort of leverage the resources that we have. But I do want to thank Burness Communications and Vox Communications, which both helped us. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation itself, which cut the check for all of this. The Engaging Richmond team that Emily told you about, we consider those community members co-investigators. So does our IRB, by the way. And so they are treated that way. And then the others noted here who all played an important role in these materials that you saw. Finally, I want to again thank Terry Wright and APHA for organizing this session. And with that, I'll keep this contact information up, but we can now open it up for discussion. Scott, your hand up, went up first.
I noticed missing was the College of Education at VCU. You were responding to the education community.
There's a simple answer to that. I forgot to put them on the slide. The School of Education, we have reached out to them. We've held meetings with them. Interestingly, their faculty don't have a particular research interest that aligns exactly with this particular initiative. So although they were briefed and were very interested and supportive of our work, we couldn't line up for this particular project a role for them in the initiative. But it began a conversation, because we're going to be continuing to work in this space. We're going to be doing more around early childhood education, and we'll probably be partnering with them on that. Yes, ma'am.
I haven't read any of the documents that you've produced, but from the presentation, the message is the longer you're in school, the better your outcomes are in terms of years. And yet, the idea of a college education is really not within the scope of most Americans. And I wonder if you can, is education just number of years? Or can you improve something that happens in education at the high school level or the grade school level or whatever? I don't know if that's part of your message.
Right. So you're talking about the distinction between educational attainment, which is typically measured in terms of the number of years of education, and the quality of the education,
right,
and the content of the education. And clearly that's important. Unfortunately, a lot of our public health statistics about the connections between education and health are tied to educational attainment. Often, for example, because vital statistics, you know, come from death certificates, and that's the piece of information about education that's on the death certificate, is how many years of education you've had. But in other areas too, most of the stuff that's put out by the National Center for Health Statistics and so forth, the prevalence rates that Derek was showing, are all reported out by educational attainment. So we don't have as strong a science base, but a lot of people do believe that there is important health implications associated with the quality of the education, both the content cognitively of what's taught, and as well as Emily was pointing out, the social experience of being a student and going through that whole process, that probably has important health implications. But the empirical data are not as where we'd want it to be. Yes.
I saw a business case once on preschool, and that, you know, like if a kid attends preschool, they're more likely to be reading by grade level 3, which is supposed to be an indicator for later for smoking and obesity and all this other stuff. I don't know if you guys have done any work on this. Or
yeah, so I mentioned earlier that the return on investment, issue where we were talking about how very commonly when you talk to business people or frankly people in the government about making investments in early childhood education, the concern that's raised is, well, yeah, but it's going to take decades before we would see the benefits of that. And I mentioned that there's an increasing body of evidence showing more immediate returns. So the example you just pointed out is one of them. Another one that I'm particularly fond of is work that's gone on out of NYU, where a series of randomized controlled trials have showed that parental engagement and engagement of teachers has resulted in and this is an engagement around helping kids with self-regulation, has resulted in reductions in ADHD and obesity by second grade. So children that young, you already see a separation of the curves. This was demonstrated first in a high-risk group of schools in Harlem. They then replicated the same model in all schools in Brooklyn and got the same results, so even though this is not a high-risk population. And the state of New York is interested in expanding it further. So examples like that, I think, are going to be helping to change the thinking and the hesitation of policymakers and many business leaders about the ROI of investing in it in early childhood education. Charlie. Interesting question. So I think what you're saying is, why didn't we go beyond just raising awareness and actually advocate a particular policy?
I'm not asking whether you're trying to advocate a policy. I'm more curious how you're going to measure success.
Yeah, fair question.
What's the impact of what you're doing? What is the impact you're really trying to achieve?
So, and this is something we struggle with a lot at the center. But in terms of, just give you a straight answer to your question, our goal was to connect the dots. So our message to the policymakers was, we're not going to get into the weeds about what approach you're going to take on early childhood education, or how you're going to make college more affordable, or how you're going to deal with a high school dropout problem. There's a menu of potential policy strategies. But just understand that the decisions you make on that health education issue have health implications. Connect the dots and understand those are wired together. There is a temptation to go beyond that and actually take a position on the policy because there's so much evidence about the benefits of those strategies. But the goal for this project was at least to get people up to the level of awareness that those are connected. And the results that we think are markers of success are like the example you made of people being able to use these materials to make their case. So many of those education organizations that we showed on the slides are out there now using our materials and making that argument as they make their pitch for different education strategies. They're able to layer in, along with all the other reasons they give for why there should be more money spent on education or particular reforms make sense, the fact that this will also help our kids live longer, reduce disease rates, and improve population health. So that, for us, is a success. Okay, yes, ma'am.
I have a question about who's informed and has access to this information. One, for the Committee for Education Funding, when I looked under the A's, I didn't see the American Academy of Pediatrics. Are they a part of it? It might be a good group to...
So they would not be grouped under our education organizations, they would be grouped under our healthcare organizations. So the healthcare organizations were targeted also as part of our communication strategy, but not that we didn't. The slide you saw was a bunch of education organizations.
Oh, okay. And then the other question was, so the American Academy of Pediatrics, and I'm presuming on the healthcare side, they are. I'll ask a different question.
Okay.
To parents through that.
That's a good idea. I don't think we had thought of that. Thank you.
I don't know how to do that.
Yeah.
Well, I will say, though, informally, you know, some of the community researchers have taken that video and on their own Facebook pages. We didn't have it in the presentation. But it's going out in that community because, you know, they're part of the research team. So it is getting out. I'm giving the order. Kind of informal.
Okay, I want to sort of move around the room. So yes, ma'am, back.
The highest priority opportunity for public health practitioners to contribute or change practices, and to what extent do we need a more in-depth understanding of the pathways for that?
Oh, two hard questions. Okay, so. I feel funny about answering all the questions. Derek, given your public health background, do you want to talk a little bit about, say, for a public health department, how they might be wanting to apply and be helpful in this regard?
In which way? Yeah.
Well, I'm wondering about, first of all, in terms of sort of a health and all policies approach, reaching out to their partners in government around education and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, so it really just helps. Part of the issue is we talk about the silos in government. It's even more pronounced, you know, than in universities and even within health departments. There's silos of even areas of health. So one of the ways in like our Virginia Department of Health is this having data that cuts across government agencies gets the attention of both commissioners and even. When you start talking about overall costs, instead of just talking about healthcare expenditures and should you expand Medicaid or not, and what kind of coverages should we have, when you start talking about how education is influencing healthcare, then that gets the attention outside of the small local leadership. Like instead of the little division directors only concerned about their specific area, you can get up at the commissioner level and the governor's level. They start talking about the whole budget and concerned about that. So it has been helpful in kind of that we talk about those conversation starters is just getting a conversation started about how these kinds of programs can influence the other and it can open some doors for data sharing and interest and just getting that first step because there's almost no data sharing across agencies like education and health. So it's been helpful in Virginia to help us start generating that conversation and sitting people at the table and start talking about data sharing across that will provide some of the information that is needed because without the data we can't even evaluate the return on investment and potential.
Yeah, and you know the silo problem is pervasive, and so you see this all around the country. The public health departments are not necessarily in meetings with the people that are dealing with the school board and so forth. But an encouraging trend we're having it in our state that we're pretty excited about. We did have an election of a new governor, and he is very interested in population health, and in particular early childhood issues. So a early childhood cabinet has been formed by the lieutenant governor, chaired by the Secretary of Health and Human Services and the Secretary of Education, bringing together the various. Cabinet level agencies and staff and leadership to come up with an approach toward trying to improve conditions for children. So those kinds of patterns I think are encouraging. Yes, ma'am.
When you listed your collaborative agencies, I didn't see the American College Health Association. And I noticed that much of your presentation is centered on early childhood intervention. But what I'm finding is that we do so much to help students to get to college. And it's kind of like after they graduate from high school, if they are successful in doing so, they're kind of dropped off the bottom of the cliff. They don't have resources. They don't fit into categories. They have
Well, I think you've identified an important area, especially with the at-risk students that are coming into college. I will say, though, that particular organization and others dealing with college issues were included in our outreach. It's just that I didn't want to tie up time with multiple slides listing. I mean, there were like dozens and dozens of organizations that we reached out to, so they were among them, the College Board and others as well. But you hit on an important issue, which is how you can't just assume that once people are enrolled in college, you're all done, and everything's going to get better. And increasingly, the data are showing that whereas high school diplomas used to be the dividing line where you started to see a big difference in health outcomes, in today's knowledge economy, it's going to be graduate school that's going to start functioning that way. And just having a college degree may not be enough to predict optimal health outcomes. So I think, you know, the issues you raised are important and need to be prioritized. I see a hand way in the back. Well, I mean, this is going to sound like a cop-out, but I'm going to say that I don't have a good answer for this, but I do feel very strongly in a forum like this at APHA that this is something our public health community needs to take more seriously, is how do we develop the capacity, now that we're understanding the importance of communication, and this is not something we've typically had a concentration on in our schools of public health or in our professional meetings, frankly. The science of marketing, the science of communication is advancing very quickly. We're in an information age, and there's a real need for us not only to master those skills, but also to come up with affordable mechanisms for people in public health to use those that don't involve going to these expensive firms. And so we, as a public health community, need to start coming up with creative models where we can do that kind of work. I mean, our resourceful way of doing it at an academic institution is to reach out to graduate students and others who can help us with this, or, you know, be fortunate enough to have funders like Robert Wood Johnson Foundation that will bring in a communications firm. But for the average public health challenge, we need to have a more generalizable model where we can apply those principles.
Sure, go ahead.
I would just add that, you know, if you're dealing with local issues at your school and your school district, and it is really important how health impacts education. I think that having an opportunity to share the voices of your students and the parents and the nurses and that are in your schools will catch the attention of the folks that you need to reach. So however you can do it, whether you interview a few folks, or you hold a focus group, or you just talk to your students or your families one-on-one, but capture some stories. And I think that if you get some stories, people will pay attention, because they really need to know the impact at the individual level and how those individual impacts add up to really affect your school and your district, yeah, and have a collective impact on what's going on.
Okay, we have about 5 more minutes for other questions. I'm gonna call on her first, Scotch, and then I'll get to you. Yes. Sure, and that's BASCH for the spelling of Charles Bash. Scotch?
The only comment I was going to make is our question, in point of fact, so much of education is all local. I mean, local school boards, local, really, really do run the schools, PTAs. And I wonder if there's any strategy, Steve, that you are thinking about bringing boards of health or governing organizations of the health department and boards of school boards in better juxtaposition. Again, it's a strategy, not an awareness issue. But I wonder if the local level, and I saw it clicked off, how one moves about the process of beginning to get health departments to think about social determinants, including education, and begin to meet with the school board. The school board to understand why somebody here from the health department.
Do you want to say something, Albert, about what's happening in Richmond?
So in our city, we have the deputy director of the health district. Also, we have one of the school board members, another public health professional, Mike Worcester. They're all coming together with this health and all policies group, and they're putting together and pulling together school board, city council, all those different stakeholders together to talk about the same issue. And sometime in January or February, we're going to be presenting to them and bringing up the conversation and helping them bear through some of the challenges. But how we approach those kind of folks is, right, going out, talking with them, letting them know what we do. And it's important to have somebody on the ground who knows folks and who are comfortable with talking with them and really just hanging out. And that's really how you have to do it. You just have to hang out with them and develop those relationships. And then after you develop that rapport, they're more interested and open to hear what you have to say. It's hard to tell a friend, though.
Yes.
Well, I would like to suggest that we consider maybe expanding from just communication to expand it to include health literacy. And the reason why is you can have communication, but not necessarily increase health literacy. But you can't have health literacy without communication. So if we expand our thinking to include it to health literacy, this is to help impact on health outcomes. And there's pretty good research in this area.
Mm-hmm.
It would also be
right. Health literacy, and there's other related disciplines like journalism and other domains that I think we need to be bringing under our fold so that we can marshal their talents and resources. Well, I'm conscious of the time, so I want to thank you for attending our session, and I hope you had a good time.